Welcome to Get Real, Talking Mental Health and Disability. I'm Robin Hayden. This is the 15th episode in our lived experience series, where we're speaking with some remarkable people who've experienced and overcome adversity and who are sharing their stories and experience in a way that might help other people in need of support. In this episode of Get Real, we meet Bruce Perham. Bruce is a social worker of more than 30 years who's also a family and narrative therapist. He's the director of a counselling collective called Talking Differently, which specialises in the area of occupational fatigue within frontline responder professions. Bruce's career has mainly been in the not-for-profit sector, and more than a decade ago, he moved into working with first responders, in particular prison officers, around the psychological impact of their constant exposure to traumatic incidents through their occupation. This experience and the organisational training and counselling Bruce has conducted over the years led him to write a book. It's called Code Blue, Prison Officer in Danger. We know through some of the conversations we've had on this podcast that first responders are particularly vulnerable to trauma. And in Code Blue, Bruce makes the point that the work of prison officers and their day-to-day experiences are largely hidden, unlike the police or firefighters or ambulance officers. The public actually don't see what life in prison is like or understand that prison officers are in a workplace of constant high stress that requires vigilance at all times. I've read it. It's a fascinating, it's a confronting book, and it's about the physical and mental impacts that first responders in a prison environment face in the course of their work to keep communities safe. So a listener note before we start, if you're affected by anything discussed in this episode, call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Welcome, Bruce. It's great to have you join us.
Hi there.
Awesome to have you. So, Bruce, you've certainly had a lot of experience in your career as a social worker and, in fact, in disability. It was one place that you've spent quite a lot of time. Can you tell us about the kind of work you did prior to working with first responders as you do now?
Yeah, certainly, Robin. My first job was with a special needs adoption agency at the ripe old age of 23, and worked with an organisation that largely placed older children and children with special needs with adoptive families. I stayed there for 3 years, but it was challenging work in terms of being that age, being childless, not really having any experience of the actual adoption process, and interviewing couples and deciding whether they could adopt children or not was very, you know, my age. It was just, I just found it very, I don't know, I can't really put a word to it. But anyway, so I moved on from there and was successful in getting a job at the Spastic Society, which I think is now called Scope or Able Australia. I've just lost, it certainly has had a
Scope,
name
I think, yeah.
But back then it was the Spastic Society at two day centres and a residential unit. Now, I had no idea of people with cerebral palsy, and there are other disabilities as well. And I was there for just under 4 years. It was just an amazing learning experience in terms of the complexity of their lives. It was back in those days, it was in the early 80s where Annie was coming out and in the movie, and a lot of people with disabilities were accessing the community in a way that they'd never accessed the community before. Probably the thing that shocked me the most was the level of mental health issues within particularly the residents in our accommodation unit, and some who had quite severe psychiatric illnesses. And back in those days, it was really common for me to be trying to get them admitted into Royal Park to get some type of help, and the complexity of the disability, the mental health system as it was back then. And when I got to sort of understand their family histories and would hear stories of these young kids being, you know, left in rooms and locked rooms and no day programs, and it was pretty dark dark stuff for me at that time in my career. So that was probably the most demanding job I've ever had, in just the enormity of the needs of the clients and the families and the lack of services back in those days and large institutions. I can remember visiting Sunbury and being just overwhelmed by it was just like stepping into a facility 100 years ago. So there was a lot that wasn't working and there was all sorts of issues. And so I then moved on from there, I think probably a bit exhausted really, and went to the MS Society, which was a very different, I was a senior social worker there and was there for 15 years. So, you know, and that was a very different disability, being a neurological disability, but with physical and cognitive complications as well. So it was a very different experience. So, so I was very, very caught up in that.
So having been in that social work space, you know, in multiple kind of environments and dealing with different types of complexity, you know, that's where you had come from when you moved into this space of working with prison officers and working in that system. So we're going to talk a little bit about your book, of course. That's what we're here to talk about. The book is called Code Blue, Prison Officer in Danger. And the work that you've done with prison officers, in your book you talk about correction fatigue, which is also called occupational fatigue, I think. And, you know, at the start, so that's what a lot of the book is about, is sort of detailing people's lived experience of what that's like for them. But at the beginning of the book, you talk about your own lived experience of mental health challenges and stress-related anxiety. And obviously you'd worked in some stressful occupations yourself prior to this. And this led you into counselling and to understanding the impact of a traumatic event in your life, which was the loss of your sibling, your twin sister, Leanne. Could you talk a little bit about this and why you chose to write about that experience? And you wrote about that at the start of your book.
Yes, and I agonised over it for some period of time. And I'll probably just a couple of comments of that. I knew in growing up, I don't remember Leanne, but I knew that it had been without putting words to it, a traumatic incident for my whole family. I knew it had definitively been a great trauma for my mother. So I was aware of all of that. I grew up with that. What I wasn't aware of was I wasn't aware of the impact that that had on me as a child. And so when I got to, you know, probably late high school, early uni, I thought I was fine. I thought I was okay. I never talked much about Leanne. I never did. But I would have said, if you talked to me then, I would have said my life was pretty good and it was going well. And I was studying social work, so I was pretty happy with how things were going. And it was when I was at the Spastic Society, I did a home visit, and I've written about that in my story in the book. And it was to a very distressed mother who had a very disabled child and was very distressed. And you know, at one point I said to her, look, we're here to help you. And she really retaliated and said, you can't help me. There's nobody that can help me. And I've just felt, I really felt, it was hard to put words to it, but it was just like a grenade went off. I knew the minute that it happened that something had gone wrong. I had no idea what. But it was sort of really terrifying in a way to then try and hold myself together for the rest of the session. I went out with the occupational therapist, drove back together. You know, I didn't mention it to her, but I was just trying to hold myself together. And I don't think I put in the book, but the next day when I got up, I felt faint and dizzy and fell back on the bed. And my partner then, Julie, now my wife, looked at me and said, what's wrong?
Yeah.
And I had no idea. But that was the beginning of not being right. And then, as I talk about in my story, that was then a long period of time of unraveling that, and to really kind of understand the level of the traumatic reaction took decades, really. Mm. But why I put that in the book and why I connected that to the work I do with prison officers and police and other first responders is the trigger. And so many people I've sat with over the years in counselling will talk about an incident, and most will say it was by no means the worst incident that they'd been involved in, but it's just like the wheels fell off and the deck of cards just went everywhere. So I sort of thought, as the author, if I gave some understanding in very different circumstances, very different types of trauma, but that I do know what it's like, and not that I ever tell anybody that. Yeah. It's just something that I have a deep understanding of it from a personal point of view.
Yeah. I think in terms of post-traumatic stress, and we've spoken to people in multiple contexts on the podcast who've had experience of this, that sounds very familiar, whether you're talking to somebody, you know, who's come from a veterans background, or somebody who's worked in humanitarian situations, or somebody who's gone through, you know, severe bullying and, you know, in their upbringing. It's that cumulative. It's what's that one thing? And it's not about the one thing. It's about the many, many things that preceded that.
Yes. Yeah. And the I can't remember whether I talk about too much in the book, but it's the having no awareness of what's happening to you. And I know, you know, in sitting with police and prison officers, they'll say to me, I'm just not who I was. You know, I used to walk into the station, or I used to walk into the prison, and, you know, I was not top gun as such, but I was, you know, really out there revving people up. Let's go, let's go, let's go. Mm. And now I sit in the car and shake and can't leave the driveway. And with, you know, you just don't understand what's going on. And even working in the field, you know, it's taken me a long time to really get a sense of what was actually happening, and the impact of grief on the brain. So, you know, I really do identify with that, of just not knowing what the hell is going on. And often people have very, you know, I certainly talk about in Code Blue, very little preparation for it. There's very little in the training that any of those occupations do that really alerts you to the psychological risks over time of doing this work, or the critical things that you need to do, to be able to manage it, and there's just nothing really in and before we did this podcast, I was thinking back to my social work days in training, and we used to do these what we call prac labs, where we'd have to go in with a problem, and then someone would interview you about the problem, because even back then, you know, in the mid 70s, there was a recognition of that you do counselling when you're stuffed up yourself, so that, you know, it was really, really the thin thing of everybody that does counselling has got so many problems themselves. That's why they do counselling. So we had to do these interviews with each other to unravel any demons and, you know, any issues that could affect our counselling. And look, I do look back and think, my God, you know, how simplistic that was in terms of the complexity of these mental health conditions. So I do chuckle sometimes when I think of the labs and making up problems to practice on each other.
Well, we've certainly come a long way since then. There's a lot better understanding of, you know, what works, and evidence around what works. But then there are areas where we are still feeling our way and where, I guess, you know, there are formal supports and informal supports and, you know, how those things combine to actually give people the right level of support. And I know, you know, you've said and acknowledged that the support of family and loved ones is really critical for people when they are experiencing mental health issues. And Julie, your wife, sounds like she's been incredibly patient and understanding, yes, as a partner to you. So if you're comfortable, could you tell us a little bit about Julie and her support of you as you sort of went through that incident and in terms of the work, supporting you in the work that you do also?
Yeah, Julie always, I didn't, but Julie always thought I would get through it. And I think I do allude to it into the first chapter. There was a time when I was really severely depressed, and I did think if this is me forever, I don't know that I could do it. And whereas Julie was resolute in that, you know, you will get through it. And I think in all of it, in the 2 or 3 years when I was seeing a psychiatrist, I think I had about 6 weeks off work, and most of the time I was able to force myself to go to work. And in that 6 weeks, all I wanted to do was go to bed, and Julie knew that. And so she would say, "Oh, we will ring you randomly in the afternoon to check whether you've done your jobs or not." And so I would know that at best I could be in bed for a couple of hours, and that Julie would ring to find out what I had done, or she'd make me go for a run, or, you know, and anybody with depression knows that you just don't want to do any of those things. And Julie would make me. She would say, "You have to go for the run, or if we need a passport, you have to go into Birth, Deaths and Marriages and get your birth certificate." And I can remember, I spent sort of about half an hour trying to get the courage to go in and ask for my birth certificate. And I wouldn't have gone in other than I knew that Julie would say, "Well, what the hell, why didn't you go in and do it?" So she pushed me when I didn't want to be pushed. But I guess I kind of knew she was right. I kind of knew that that she was right and that I needed to do these things. But I look back and I think, you know, how can you go to a milk bar and not go in to get a litre of milk? I just couldn't do it. I just could not go in and buy a litre of milk. And I still don't know that I quite fully understand that, but it is just so debilitating when you can't do any of those things. And one point I was just going to say that I think is different and partly why I connected so much with the prison work and the police work is that back when I went through my major depression, I saw myself as being weak, as pathetic, really. I never saw it, and nobody else did, as a workplace exposure to trauma. Never even thought of it, never occurred to me. And yet I look back now and I think, well, that was a workplace trauma. You know, still dealing with very challenging situations. I have done all my life. Had no idea what I was going into, and certainly back then, if someone had have said that in any way that was connected to workplace trauma, not the primary trauma, but certainly a secondary trauma, it just wouldn't have, you know, no one would have even thought about that. So what I always encourage people now is, and particularly for prison officers, for police, you know, the mental health reactions are almost, for a lot of us, unavoidable. You know, they're not weakness. They're not in any way that you're not equipped to do what you're doing. It's just the human side of us every now and again takes over.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you actually wrote in the book that you came to understand when you were experiencing your anxiety and depression, that looking back, I see more clearly that the workplace was the stage that re-triggered my childhood trauma, yes, and ostensibly had caused me so much turmoil. And it sounds like that realization really did prepare you better in your work as a social worker and now with the work that you're doing with, yes, first responders, because you're able to say to them, there's a reason for this, right? You know, it's not just you. You haven't all of a sudden become a different person.
No.
Overnight.
No. And And, you know, it was a long time later when I realised that that mother that I'd visited really triggered back into my own mother. And, you know, probably, I don't know, maybe that was obvious to other people. It certainly wasn't obvious to me. But the level of grief in that exchange, I just think it was the arrow that really just broke all the defences down. And I think there's a lot of people with PTSD would identify with that, of the walls just collapse. You know, I couldn't tell you what was going on, but it just collapses. And one thing I'll just throw in, I remember sitting when I went to the GP and he said, look, maybe you need a couple of sessions with a psychiatrist. And I thought, me? No, my God, no. That, you know. But he said, look, there'll only be five or six sessions and you'll be good to go. And I remember sitting in the waiting room and it had, fill in your family history. And it got to, you know, siblings. And I thought, I'm not going to put Leanne in because I know he'll seize on it. And at that point, I was convinced that wasn't the problem. It was all a work problem. It was not anything to do with work. It was all about me. I mean, not anything to do with Leanne. But I did put her down. I thought, no, I have to put Leanne down. And so I put Leanne down, bracket deceased. And I thought, he'll be all over that. He'll be all over it. I know that he will be. And yet he wasn't until at some point he asked me, had I ever what was the most pain I'd ever felt? What was the most grief I'd ever felt? And I talked about the girlfriend I had before Julie, who Michelle, who had broken up our relationship and I was shattered, and I talked about that. And that was probably, I don't know, 6 months into seeing him. And then I cried all the way home. I had to, I think Julie had come out from work and we were going to drive home together. I had to get Julie to drive home. You know, I was so distressed. And so, there was the trigger and then there was all the chaotic months after that. But then there was that, in that starting to penetrate that grief, and then the wheels really then fell off and I had to go on antidepressants and all of that. So, and partly that's what I do get in terms of when I sit with people of that. And I at the start of the book where I talk about the officer I was sitting with that and the numbness that he just described, the numbness, and it's sort of when I really started to think, you know, I know what that numbness is like. I know when, you know, you sit there and there'd be times I'd say nothing and then there'd be times I'd cry the whole time and say nothing. And that, you know, that the time that it takes – And often we all, people say to me, I just want to be over this anxiety shit, you know. When can we knock it down? And the time that it takes to actually work these things out.
Yeah. And it's, you know, there's a lot to process and there's a lot to kind of absorb in different environments as well. And it changes every time. It's the same but different, I guess.
Yes.
So I'm really interested in, you know, how you came to be involved in the world of corrections, because you hadn't had any real exposure to that environment before you started working with prison officers, and you'd mainly worked with children and families. How did you end up working with prison officers? How did that start for you?
When I started working privately, a friend of mine was working with an EAP provider, employee assistance provider, and he said, look, chuck in your CV and, you know, I'll pass it on to the senior psychologist, which I did. And so I started doing some work for them just as what's called an associate counsellor. And I got a phone call one morning to go out to one of the high security prisons in Melbourne, and a prisoner committed suicide, and it was to do what we call a critical incident debrief with the prison officers. Mm-hmm. So I sat with these five officers and they talked about what they'd been through, and it's the first time I'd ever been into a prison. It was the first time I'd ever really thought about anything that happens in a prison. And as I was going, the senior psychologist sort of grabbed me and she said, look, you know, I'm really concerned about the lack of use of the service of EAP that for officers. Would I think of coming in on site and being actually in the prison so officers could come and see me in person, which I was more than happy to do. And so I started going in there and some of the other prisons as well. So yeah, just evolved, you know, and just having these conversations with people and starting to get an understanding of the issues that they would bring to me and just the complexity of what they had to deal with and, you know, what their families had to deal with.
Yes, and the story of Neil O'Rourke, who's the prison officer who you knew in a social capacity and who was, you know, part of, you know, your real introduction into what happens in that corrections world, he features quite prominently in your book, and he was obviously supportive of you detailing his experience. Can you tell us more about Neil in relation to the workplace of prison experience of prison officers? There are other stories throughout the book, but Neil's is kind of the through line, I guess, and you got to know him quite well. Tell us a little bit about, you know, his experience of
Yeah, and look, Neil, you know, as the book outlines, you know, went into the prison system at Pentridge in the old Pentridge days and then stayed in the prison system. And but he, in knowing him socially, when I was working at the prison, or when I started work at the prison that he was working at, you know, I'd bump into him, say, hi, how you doing at the prison? And we'd catch up occasionally socially. And he came to see me one day in the prison and he'd been in a very traumatic incident. He was really quite distressed. And, you know, I was aware of, you know, it's a real no-no to be providing counselling for someone you know. We just don't do it. And, you know, sort of in a way, I agree, it's not really ethical. But in this situation, and he said to me, look, I just would rather talk to you who I know than to talk to a stranger. And so we just agreed that it would only be about work, that it wouldn't be about family relationships or any other aspect of his life, but that I'd be happy to talk to him about work. So he would come and see me, I don't know, maybe once every 3 or 4 months, or particularly if they'd been in an incident, and he was in a lot because of the type of officer that he was. And it's sort of it gave me a different insight because I knew him and I could really see he was on the edge, and I talk about that. I just had such a, what's the word, foreboding sense of you're one trauma away from, you know, really being in trouble. And and then he had his one trauma event, which was a prisoner died. We talk a bit about it in the book, and that was it. He hasn't been back to work since. He just couldn't deal with that. So I did 5 interviews with him after that. He'd left and was on work cover. And what I was aiming to do was to help him, but to get an understanding of what did he do with the emotion of the job over those 30 years? How did he deal with the emotional component of what he was doing? And because I'd all, you know, from the officers and the training I do, you know, I've already was well aware of how hard it was for officers to emotionally process these experiences, partly because there wasn't time, partly because the system is probably better at single event trauma, not so good at tracking a cumulative trauma over periods of time. And Neil would talk about the get back on the horse, don't let the crims know they've beaten you. So there was almost this frenetic to just get back in there and don't let anybody know that you've been wounded. But then not processing the emotional content of the experience, and so in these post-work interviews, he just found it, and he would say himself, he just found it so hard to, but he would talk about, you know, he cries at anything now, and that he's, you know, has been very depressed at different times, and his adult children reflect that he'd be in his room for days and wouldn't come out, and, you know, they reflected this extreme, as does his wife Anne, you know, withdrawal behaviour. And in, I'm not sure what made the book and what didn't, but he would say, but I never thought about them. Mm. I was so engrossed in what was happening to me. He said, I never really even stopped to think about the impact on the kids or on Anne. So it just gave, and he would say to me, you know, I just want to bash your head in. You know, this is traumatic to bring it back. But I wouldn't be asking him what happened. He'd be telling me. And I think there's a psychological misunderstanding around that in that I often think if people tell me something, I'm not asking them to tell me it, but if they tell me something, it's already very much in their mind. But Neil would categorically say that it was very useful for him to, you know, go back and really try and gain some understanding, because he was doing that constantly himself anyway. But in terms of the emotion, he would acknowledge he just really struggles to connect with it.
Yeah, and, you know, over the course of our podcast, we've heard from other guests with lived experience of PTSD that it's an incredibly isolating experience, and it's hard to explain to people, especially to their families, and it sounds like that's certainly the case here. What is it for you that you've discovered about the experience of prison officers that made you realise that perhaps their experiences were somewhat different to other first responders?
Look, I did a series. I did 40 training sessions in 2016 in the 4 high security prisons. And that was where I just sat with probably about between 12 and 15 officers in a session, very free-flowing. They were group discussions. I would ask who finds being a prison officer stressful, and away we'd go. And a lot of the comments from Code Blue have come out of that training. And, you know, every group I did would say to me, we never sit and talk about our mental health ever as a group, ever. We've never done this before. And would really open up and would really, which, you know, in a way, despite having this culture of being tough, bottle it up, you know, when you actually gave people the opportunity to talk, they took it, you know, really. And, you know, there'd always be a couple of officers that sat with their arms crossed and never engaged. But the vast majority really took the opportunity to talk about their mental health and really enjoyed it, you know, really enjoyed the opportunity to, and in a way, for someone like me to be reflecting back, you know, this is psychologically very complex work. And I thought, oh, no, it's nice, just what we do. And, you know, watching people slash up and, you know, the examples I put in Code Blue are by no means the worst. I actually went middle ground because, you know, I'm well aware of it's traumatic enough to read Code Blue in lots of ways. Well, you know, but there are situations where the officers were exposed to far worse than what's in Code Blue. And yet that have this sort of, it's just a part of the job, you know. And I say, well, yeah, it is, but it's a highly complex part of the job. And, you know, most of us in the workplace don't have to deal with it, never deal with it, and never have to. That's why one of the reasons for Code Blue, see, the number of codes that officers have to respond to that are all fight or flight, activate your cortisol, high level of awareness to go to any of the codes that they might go to. And they might do that 50 or 60 times a month. Now, that's exhausting, you know, and none of us ever do it. You know, I think I had to fire off my fight or flight once when I got a bit close to the tram, you know. I'm going to kick it into gear and move, you know, like we just generally don't don't need to use it. And these occupations, first responders, are using it all the time. And there's very little awareness of this is exhausting for people. And officers and police officers will tell me it can be a day or two or more before they can bring themselves down from this hypervigilant sort of state. So I guess the more I sat with people and the more I did the training, the more I realized how little is understood about what these people are actually experiencing and the significant impact it is having on them in terms of life-changing impact. And yet we don't seem to be saying anything.
And it is an environment that's not like other environments in many ways. They're, you know, working every day in close quarters with people, many of the same people, so it's not a stranger incident. I remember reading a part of the book where you talked about getting close to prisoners and, you know, prison officers, you know, they have to process some pretty serious incidents, not just I think what you've talked about as routine assaults on themselves or other prisoners, but suicides like the one reported for a prisoner named Jimmy, where the officer who related that story was really deeply affected and blamed themselves for missing the signs of that. So at the same time as that's happening, then there was another story that was being related about, you know, where the officer was working with an Aboriginal inmate over time who'd been in and out of prison and teaching them to read in the hopes that that person wouldn't come back to prison, and in the end they didn't. So it's a real spectrum of, you know, getting close to people and having those moments and then having those other traumatic moments and then having all of the flight, fight and freeze in between, yes. Almost.
Yes, and yeah. And Neil would often say, you know, I wear my losses hard, you know, when I don't save a prisoner. And the majority of officers are the same. They will persecute themselves about could they have done something different. So the loss of life to them is a significant trauma.
Mm.
And yet often people in the community will say, oh, well, that's good, another one gone. You know, there's often quite unsympathetic. Why would you try and resuscitate you know, a deceased prisoner?
Mm-hmm.
And all the officers do. You know, it's highly traumatic to do it.
Yeah.
But they will all go in and try and resuscitate. And you know, officers say to me, you know, people say, why'd you bother? You know, just let them go, you know, in the community, people in the public. And, you know, so you hear that and you think that you know, they give so much of themselves to the work. And probably the critical thing for me was with no recognition. And, you know, I can look back at what I went through, but, you know, counselling generally has as well respected, you know, if you say you're a counsellor, oh, that's be really good, you know, don't know how you do it. Or if you're a policeman or you're a fiery or SES or a paramedic, or, you know, there's awareness of the valuable role that these people play in the community. And I think that helps, you know, if you feel in certain situations you are making a difference. And, you know, for medical people, you might lose a client, but you save a client, you know, that you arrive for somebody that's drug affected on the street and you can save their life. But sometimes that you might not be able to save their life. But there's still some, some positiveness, or it's visible about what you do. Mm. For prison officers, there's nothing. They get no, you know, and that's probably what I identified with the most, you know, they get no recognition. Nobody ever says to me, wow, that is amazing that we have these people looking after the most difficult people in our community day after day.
Yeah.
I never hear that. I hear people say to me, oh, they just run drugs in, don't they? Or you know, we just have some major stereotypical views about what prison officers do. So Code Blue is really to challenge that and to go, no, hang on, these are people living their lives with a lot of passion for what they do and a deep commitment for what they do, but they feel they get crushed. And, you know, and I've had people say Code Blue is anti-management. not necessarily. It's just what that's what officers tell me. That's what they share. That's their view of the world. And probably, Robin, as a generic point, we don't listen enough to how people describe their worlds and their lived experience. And we just don't listen enough to it. And we don't really, and in the workplace, we don't really try and understand it, you know. As a senior person, I need to get in and really understand how these prison officers, what they go through, what they think, what they feel, what's the impact that this is having on them. Because there's great truth, you know, when you talk to people about their belief about their own lives, there's great truth in what they say.
Yeah.
And we just don't listen to it.
And as a community, you know, we've come a long way in understanding stereotypical views that we hold about other professions, and you know, this is important to be able to help people change their perceptions about what this is really like, because this is valuable work. It's work that society needs to do. We need people to do it, and we need people to understand what the people who are doing this work, you know, are exposed to, and also how we can help them to get through that. So I think that's really, really important. There was in your book, and you've talked about this a little bit, there's a specific course that you deliver to corrections staff, and it's called From Correction Fatigue to Fulfillment. That was developed in the US by Dr. Katarina Spinaris. Can you tell us about that course and what you discovered when you travelled to the US and attended this course yourself? Because I think in the book you say occupational fatigue, which is referred to here as correction fatigue, is actually a process of personality change that compounds over time in response to repeated exposure to trauma and associated stresses.
Yeah, look, I can't remember exactly how I came across Katarina, but I went over and did her course in 2017. I was the first counsellor that ever had gone and done the course. That it's actually a peer education model. So she trains prison officers to go back into their prison and deliver the training. But because I was from Australia and I don't think we're going to send a busload of prison officers over to do the training, I went and did it myself, and she was happy for me to do it. And look, she's been in the correction industry for 20 years, and she's obviously sat with a lot of prison officers and done a lot of research into the mental health and well-being of prison officers. And the correction fatigue, the core thing for that is that, as what Katarina says, is that if you be continually traumatised in the workplace, that means multiple people are continuously traumatised in the workplace, and that if they're not supported and it's not dealt with and the right support structures aren't there, it impacts on behaviour, and then you start to find the workplace becomes toxic because you've got so many people working with what she calls correction fatigue or burnout or PTSD, and then that impacts on how people start to relate to each other, which when I, you know, really got to understand that, I could see it. You can see it in terms of the level of trauma within these workplaces, and then you've got 30 or 40%. I actually did the correction fatigue training at a rural prison last year, and did four groups of about 45 senior officers. So they were sort of like not junior officers, senior officers. There wasn't one that didn't put themselves somewhere on the correction fatigue continuum. They all acknowledged a level of trauma in themselves, and you know, they're responsible for supervising and dealing with the junior officer's trauma. So it's trying to get people aware of, well, yes, you are traumatized, and that's to be expected. And the fulfillment part is that you can either go downhill with that, or you can try and intervene in it. And Katarina's done a lot of work. We're nowhere near here where they are there in working with organisations to, as she refers to it, you know, if if the bottom's going to change, the top has to change.
Yep.
So that if you're going to change the way you think about your work and you're going to try and make your work more fulfilling, that's got to be matched by top-down change in terms of the system needs to change to enable people to feel more a sense of worth in what they do. I found that my experience here was very connected, and Katerina felt the same. You know, a lot of similarities in the level of trauma and the life-changing nature of it.
Absolutely. And the system in which people work sits in an ecosystem in which the community operates. So there's broader sort of areas of influence, and this is where I think your book is going to be so helpful in helping people to understand actually, you know, what is life like for people who work inside the prison system, and how can we better understand and be empathetic to some of the challenges that they face. So you actually describe yourself as a narrative therapist as well as a social worker. Can you tell us a little bit about what narrative therapy is and how it helps in this kind of work?
Yeah, look, narrative therapy was developed by David Epstein from New Zealand and Michael White from Adelaide, and sadly Michael passed away in 2008, so we've lost him. But I was very fortunate to do a lot of training. You know, I trek to Adelaide regularly, and he's a great teacher. And his development of narrative therapy was very much about that the individual is the expert on their own life, and that the therapist isn't. So the therapist doesn't know what's best for that person. It's through the therapeutic interchange of understanding what their lived experience is. And in a way, having a dialogue around that was how you, as Michael would sort of often say, you know, would be reconnect with lost parts of themselves, which is a wonderful idea. You know, the therapist isn't instilling it. It's that you're helping people reconnect with parts of themselves that are lost to them, as Michael used to put it. So he was a brilliant man, and I do talk about him in the book in terms of the where I felt that what had happened to me in terms of the depression, I'd seen that as failure. I felt very negative about that. I still, you know, never talked about Leanne. But, you know, in doing the training there, you know, Michael was always that maybe these experiences enrich what you do. You know, you don't need to disconnect from your lived experience, even if it's been traumatic. You know, maybe that can used to call it insider knowledge, you know, that you have insider knowledge as to these conditions. So exposure to him was enormously helpful for me to be able to go, well, okay, I've been through the loss of my twin sister and really the loss of my mother psychologically, but that doesn't need to be negative. That can be something that is useful to me, and it has been. You know, there's been different times that, you know, I've sat with families in very sad situations, and I can do that. I can sit there with them. And yet probably 25 years ago I couldn't have sat with them. So, it flipped for me in terms of maybe these experiences are useful. Maybe you can draw on them creatively rather than needing to be ashamed of them. But, you know, Michael just had great faith in everybody and always felt that every story, there'd be a story of worth if you took the time to find it.
Yeah, and you've taken the time to find many, many stories in this book. It is a fascinating book and an insight into a world that many people will never get to see. So what's the feedback been like? I know the book's only just come out recently. What's the feedback been like from prison officers and first responders?
The feedback has been really good, and I'm really well aware of it for anybody that's been in the system for any length of time. It is challenging, you know, there's a risk that people can read it and it will bring back trauma, you know, and I'm very mindful of that. But in the end, I thought a bit like what Neil went through, trauma's going to come back anyway, one way or another. And I often think if I hadn't have done that home visit to that mother and her child, would I have ever addressed what lay within? And I really don't know. I really could have gone through life and never, it would have always impacted on me. And Julie actually said to me, she said, you know, you never talked about your mother. And you never talked about, I never talked about Leanne, I never talked about Leanne to anybody, but she said, you never talked about your mum. You gave me nothing about your mum. And I wasn't even aware of that. So I look back and I think, well, yeah, what would have I been like if I hadn't had that home visit? So I do sort of have a bit of a belief that we just need to understand our trauma, and we need to know that it's okay and it is understandable that when you do this work and you give so much, it will hurt you to some degree. But that the talking about it is a way of starting to try and get some understanding of it. And it was where I got a lot of satisfaction for Neil in the time I spent with him, and for Anne, in that I think he had a better sense of what he went through, even though it was traumatic to talk about it.
Yeah. And Bruce, thank you so much for chatting to us today. You know, it's been a fascinating discussion and it's kind of flown by really quickly for me, at least, and I'm sure for our listeners too. As we come to the end of this chat, is there anything that, you know, you would like to share with us, any final thoughts, anything that you didn't get to say?
It's a generic, just in response to what we're talking about. And look, I just, in whatever life situation you're in, never doubt yourself. Always believe in yourself. And that's why I love Michael. Everyone has a story. We just need to stop and listen to it. Mm. And it's one of the things I learned so much. You know, we all race so quickly. For God's sake, I say to myself, stop and hear the story. Stop and hear what this person's trying to tell me. And so just don't doubt yourself you know, believe in your own story would be my passing or my final, wisdom.
Thank you. That is indeed very wise. Thanks so much, Bruce, for joining us today.
Pleasure, Robin.
It's absolutely fascinating to talk to you and wish you all the best with the book. It is a terrific book, and you can find out more about Bruce and his book Code Blue, Prison Officer in Danger, at the website letstalkdifferently.com.au. The details are also in the show notes for this episode. I'd like to thank Bruce again for joining us, and for our listeners, if you've been affected by anything discussed in this episode, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. I'm Robin Hayden, and you've been listening to Get Real, talking mental health and disability. Join us next time on Get Real for more conversations about mental health and disability. And if you're enjoying the podcast, we'd love you to share Get Real with your friends and networks. And subscribe to the show, that way you won't miss an episode. You can also rate and review Get Real on your preferred podcast listening platform. We're listed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon, Stitcher, and Pocket Casts. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, and look after yourself. We'll see you soon.